Welcome, everybody. Thanks for joining us again today for another one of the talks we're doing about various topics. This time we have sort of a three-part talk. Today is salt. In December, we're going to be doing sugar, and then the most important one, the final one, which I think we'll see a lot more of a crowd for, the sex talk. And I don't know if I'm going to be giving a lot of specifics there, but it's going to be an interesting take on the topic. Today we're talking about salt, though, and this is a topic that I think probably going to learn some things that you don't know about salt, but this is something that is part of all of our lives, something we take for granted. And as in all these talks, when I start looking up information about the topic, I find a lot of things I did not know. I want to start with a little joke about the two peanuts that were walking down the street. I don't know if you guys know this one. And they were in a bad part of the town, and one of them was assaulted. Assaulted. Anyway, yeah, no, that was a groaner. They'll get better. They'll get better. A lot of questions about salt. People wonder whether they have an appropriate amount of salt in their diet, maybe too much. All of us are concerned about that, at times at least. I love this guy. He actually has a shirt or a sweater that says this. I put salt on my salt. And you may know somebody like this. You know, salt has got a bad reputation, generally speaking, that too much of it isn't good for us. Some of that may be a little bit overstated, but salt does have some important aspects in our health, of course. It's an essential mineral in our body. Too much salt, not good for us. And we're going to talk about why that would be the case. First, before, as we do with these different talks, they all have fairly similar themes. We're going to touch on a variety of different topics. We're going to take some little side trips into some areas that don't speak to salt specifically. But we're also going to do a little bit of science, because that's where my background is. And what I want to try to do in these talks also is bring some understanding of basic science, which is just really just standard common sense thinking with a little more of a critical approach to the information. I don't know if you guys have seen this kitty cat on the internet, but these are very popular. I'm not sure what the name of the site is, but I is going to do some science. So let's talk a little bit about the science of salt. Now, we're all very familiar with salt and probably even know that salt is a crystal, of course. You see it in the salt shake. Salt is sodium chloride. You probably have heard that before, and most of us know that little bit of chemistry. Salt, made of sodium and chlorine, these two atoms are charged, which means they're ions. And this is an important feature of salt. It's what allows it to dissolve in water, okay? So it's an ionic compound, okay? It's sort of like a magnet. It has a positive and a negative charge. The positive charge is sodium. We call that the cation. That's just a name. Chloride, negative ion. Here it is in its crystal form as it dissolves. It's surrounded by the water. And of course, we've all dissolved salt in water for a variety of things. Maybe, for instance, you might have dissolved it in there for, you know, trying to soothe a sore throat. Sodium, though, is a very common element in the Earth's crust, okay? It's the sixth most common element, okay? And it's important to understand why we're made of salt, if you will, why there's so much salt in our bodies. It has to do with this fact. The Earth started quite a long time ago. I don't know if anybody knows how old the Earth is. Does anybody have a guesstimate? 4.5 billion. There you go. Okay, about 4.5 billion years, exactly. So that's a lot of time, and I think it's very hard for us to understand the concept of, if you will, of geological time. I mean, it's hard enough to understand 1 year, 10 years, 100 years. But billions of years, very difficult to understand. But because salt was in the surface, and sodium and chlorine were in the surface of the crust of the Earth, water vapor forming in the oceans, causing clouds, then raining down, and would constantly wash the salt out of the Earth's crust. And so, of course, we all know that rivers are fresh water, and the ocean is salt water. And the answer to that is, it's hard to imagine it, I guess, but over those billions of years, the water, which would constantly rain down on the surface, would take the salts out of the surface through the river water and wash it into the ocean. It would be concentrated by evaporation. So that's how come there's so much salt in the ocean. And when you try and imagine over the 4.5 billion years of time, if you took all the salt out of the ocean, it would be 40 stories high if you put it all on the land. And that's as tall as the tallest building in Phoenix, Arizona. So imagine salt covering the entire Earth, all the landmass, up to the level of the top of the Chase building downtown Phoenix. It's a pretty wild thought. There is a lot of salt in the Earth. Now, With all that salt and all the water in the oceans, it made what we call a primordial soup. This is sort of a basic hypothesis of how life came to the planet. The idea is that there's all these different chemicals, if you will, in the mixture of the water of the ocean. You add in a little bit of heat, maybe from a volcano, a little bit of lightning, and so forth. And what you do is create a chemical reaction. And they've actually done experiments like this, where if they take sort of the basic compounds that might have existed on the Earth maybe 3.5 billion years ago, add a little energy to the system, you can develop actually organic compounds that look a lot like life forms that we see today. Now, you don't see something crawling out of the ground, of course. Everybody says, how's that possible? But if you give it enough time, you can potentially imagine that you could form a single cell organism from all that chemical mixture over all those years. The simplest of the single cell organisms, which of course are many different types in the ocean, single cell organisms, they have this important feature which we've talked about before in the first talk on water. We talked about the cell membrane. This is the surrounding structure that sort of contains all the innards of the biological material, okay? So the cell membrane is very important, okay? There's lots of salt in the ocean where these organisms developed. They developed this cell membrane. It's important because this is where salt becomes very important, sodium chloride. The membrane separates the interior of the cell from the exterior, and water can travel through this cell membrane, and all of our cells, all the cells of creatures that, you know, live in the earth, single cell or multi-cell organisms. And this is called the process of osmosis, the passive motion of water across this semi-permeable, meaning slightly or permeable only to water, membrane, okay? And here we see that again depicted here, where there's lots of salt, for instance, inside this cell. There's very little here. The water will move towards the high concentration of salt. Now, aside from this passive motion of ions of salt, there's also little pumps in many cells which can pump sodium one direction and potassium another direction. These are called sodium-potassium pumps. Our body's cells have these throughout all the different cells of the body, to be honest with you. Some places like the kidney much more than other places. But the body can also affect the chemistry inside and outside the cell. The body is made of 70% water, and the body is also made of salt. Does anybody have any idea how much salt is in a human body? Guess? How much salt might there be? 70%? Anybody idea? 15%? Well, I don't know that I can give you a percent, but about a pound of salt is in each of us. So if you took about the group here, we could create from our bodies one of these 40-pound sacks of salt that we see at the grocery store. All animals look for salt, okay? And we've all heard of a salt lick. Yeah. And if you ever heard the term, somebody says it's down the road a lick, that has to do with the fact that apparently, so I've read, if you will, that animals would search for salt. And they would go down to what they called salt licks, which were areas where salt would come to the surface. And today we still supply animals with salt, needed mineral for the body's function. Here's a cow. And of course, I'm making a little bit of fun, not making an analogy here, but she's getting her margarita salt. Everybody likes their salt. Animals look for salt because salt is an integral part of our chemistry. Now, we've even developed, obviously, the ability to identify salt very specifically. It's one of the reasons it's appealing to us. And now we all know that we can tell the four basic tastes. There is a fifth one, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. And the reason we can tell that salt, and this is a tongue, by the way. Okay, so salt taste buds are on the side of the tongue. The sweet is on the tip of the tongue. Sour in the middle here, bitter in the back. And so we understand or can taste for salt because we need salt. And so the body's developed an organ, if you will, to seek it out and identify it. Same thing with sweetness or with something that's healthy for us or is good for the body, something that's a nutrient that provides energy. So we can tell what's sweet. We also can tell the sour taste and the bitter, probably for the opposite reason, so that we know what's not good for us. You combine these together and you get the different flavors that we taste, the four basic groups. Now, in the middle, there's something I want to talk about just for those who are not familiar with this flavor or taste. Is anybody familiar with umami? Yeah, no. Umami is the savory flavor, okay? So it's the fifth flavor. Interesting. People don't realize that, I mean, people, you know, when you were probably kids, you might have learned there were four flavors. There actually is a fifth flavor. We'll talk a little bit about the history of that, but it's called the fifth taste. Bacon and cheeses sort of epitomize this flavor. This is a fish sauce. I don't know if anybody's ever had fish sauce at an Asian a restaurant that also has a very strong savory flavor. And there's actually a restaurant in California, I don't know if anybody's ever been to it, very tasty, called Umami Burger. It's burgers that have all these different savory flavors that they add to it. It's pretty tasty. And probably the quintessential and the first identification of it was this. And of course, now if I show you this, you guys are gonna be like, boo, bad sodium glutamate. Sodium glutamate has gotten a bad rap over the years. It was discovered in 1908 by a Japanese chemist who isolated it and basically was wondering why he couldn't identify certain flavors in seaweed. And he realized that there was the fifth flavor. And he isolated it as sodium glutamate. Now it has sodium in it, okay, so part of salt, but it's a glutamic acid is an amino acid. So it's a sodium form of an amino acid. This is what it looks like. And it's really not as bad for you as all that, to be honest with you. There are some people that can have a reaction to it, but it creates or enhances flavor by giving you the umami taste, okay, the savory flavor. And salt is important for internal balance, okay? And this fellow here, Claude Bernard, was the first modern physiologist, basically studying the biological basis of the internal processes of the body, and we call that physiology. And he coined the term homeostasis. He was French in the 1700s. And he said that homeostasis is the development of internal balance. Our bodies need to maintain an internal balance to function properly. So salt provides balance in a few ways, okay? We saw within those cells that there's salt inside the cells and there's salt. Is important for balanced blood pressure, that is in the vascular system, to maintain the quantity of liquids in the blood supply. We need to have salt in there because that draws in the liquids and keeps them there. It's not just the blood cells and the white cells, the different corpuscles that are in the blood, but there's actually plasma in there and that requires sodium as well. Now all animals have a salt drive, okay? And you've heard of the term sex drive, and a drive is very important. A drive is actually defined as a physiological need that will alter an animal's behavior, okay? So when people say you have we talk about the sex drive or the salt drive, the body actually seeks these things out. It requires it, our biology creates the need. This fellow, Paul Richter, was sort of the father of the understanding of biological drive, and he was from Hopkins, so I have a little picture from there. Always gotta bring in one of the docs from Hopkins to discuss the various aspects of the topics we're talking about. He looked at removing certain portions of, for instance, he would remove an adrenal gland from rats and would show that they would seek salt incessantly and how important that gland is to the balance of salt and the drive. The animals would do nothing but seek out salt. They would forego everything else but the need to find salt. Now, salt alters a large variety of hormones in the body. Now, this is every one of these lectures or talks, we've had a busy slide. This has way too much information on it, but the point is there's a lot going on to control salt and water in the body. The pituitary gland in the brain, the adrenal glands here near the kidneys, and then also there are hormones that are involved in both the lung and the liver that control salt balance and water balance, okay? Now, the most important organ of controlling salt and water balance is the kidney, all right? Now, the kidney is made up of 2 million little filters called nephrons, all right? And in the kidney, what happens is blood flows in enormous quantities into a little capillary tuft, and then through this filter, the blood stays in this capillary, and then the liquids or plasma is filtered through this very long tubule. It looks like something from a Rube Goldberg kind of cartoon. And it's through this process that all the various electrolytes are transformed, altered, reabsorbed, and excreted, okay, through its entire length, diving into the various areas of the kidney based on concentrations within the different tissue sections of the kidney, from the outside cortex to the internal medullary area. Now, the kidney does an enormous amount of work. It filters about 30 times the blood supply in a day. That's 50 gallons of liquid, basically, your kidneys filter in a day. It's an enormous quantity. And each gallon weighs about 8 pounds, 9 pounds. So that means your kidneys every day are filtering 440 pounds of liquid. I mean, it's a pretty wild concept, how much it's doing. So when people say to me, well, why do I have a little bit of ankle swelling? It's like, well, the kidneys don't have to be off by much, okay? 1% reduction in the kidney filtering capacity is 4 pounds, okay? A 0.25% reduction is a pound. So if you see that variation in the scale day in, day out, you're like, I didn't eat anything more. I ate the same as yesterday. It's usually due to the fact that there's a variation in your salt, water, and how much your kidneys are filtering. And the amount that your kidneys are filtering less is a very trivial amount. But that amounts to quite a lot of liquid and quite a lot of weight. So salt in balance, that's the important point for the body. When we eat too much salt, the body has to eliminate that salt, okay, in a day. And so we have an amount that we should eat, and we'll talk about the quantity of that. In the old days, we used to eat a lot more than we do now, and we know enough that it can cause problems for us. Probably the most important, or the two most essential issues, are effect on blood pressure, okay? Extra salt raises the amount of plasma in the blood volume, and that will raise the blood pressure, which then results in issues that can damage the body, including the heart. You can get thickened heart muscle, you can cause brain strokes and so forth. So salt is involved in our control of our blood pressure. So it's a very important issue for all of us. In fact, kidney function, also the eyes as well. And as we spoke of, it can lead to swelling or edema. And here's an example of what we call pitting edema, where when you push in on your foot, you see a little bit of a swollen area that sort of divots in or pushes in. That's what we call pitting edema. You can also get edema of other extremities of the arms as well. So in this person, they have too much total body salt, okay? That's what edema is. Too much salt, not in proper balance. And of course, we all recognize maybe not these pills in their branded form, now we all get generics, but diuretics are the pills that allow us to get the fluid, the extra salt and water out of the system. Here's Lasix, probably the strongest of the diuretics. This is hydrochlorothiazide. Here's Maxide, Diazide, and Aldactone. This sort of encompasses probably 95% of all the diuretics. So if a person's on a diuretic, trying to eliminate extra salt, water goes with it, and these medicines work, as we're gonna see here just briefly, along that length of that tubule, that long tubule in the kidney. It's all the different minerals are being either transported in or out of this tubule and then being reabsorbed. When they make it all the way to the end, we call that urine, of course. That's where it collects in the bladder. And these diuretics work in various areas. This area, this loop of Henle, is where the Lasix works. And that's probably the most effective in eliminating extra salt. The salt is eliminated or put into this tube, and then water follows it, and then it goes out in the bladder and the urine. So where do we get salt from? It comes from, of course, the store. No. And we all are familiar with Morton salt, obviously. But salt doesn't come from the store because humans have always wanted salt. And there are a variety of ways we get salt. But this has been 6,000 to 8,000 years. Now, of course, caveman probably knew of salt because he saw crystals on the ground or something, or he tasted the ocean water. The ways ancient people would get salt, and it went back at least 6,000 years. They would use evaporation ponds. So you'd bring the briny, salty water, you'd bring it up into a thin area where the hot air could then cause evaporation. Then you get, trying to imagine what this salt is like. It seems like it'd be pretty dirty, to be honest with you. Not the kind of salt I'd want. Of course, not everybody lives near a salt flat, but that's another place where people would scrape it together. Salt mines, too. That's another place where there are large quantities of salt. Now, where is salt in the United States? It's in a lot of places. Of course, it's at the ocean's edge, so that's not surprising. But this is a map of the United States and the salt production from the Salt Institute. U.S. and China, actually, China's now the largest producer of salt in the world. And we'll talk about why that's actually somewhat important. Here you can see a little bit. I'm not sure where that is in Arizona, but there's some salt here. There is a place in Glendale we'll talk about where we get our salt from here in Arizona. So the uses of salt, most salt isn't, we don't consume much salt, to be honest with you. The business of salt, 43% are in the, or more than 50% of all salt is used in cold countries, and almost half of that is used for roads. So salt is really not something that that Morton Incorporated is making for us to eat. That's just a trivial amount of their business. 43% for roads, 35% for chemical production, which includes making paper, dyes, soaps. Salt's very important for that. And then we also take salt, put it in water, and then if you run a current through, you can actually make chlorine gas, which is important for making about 15,000 different chemicals. So salt is intimately important for, you know, the modern world, if you will. And then only 3% is for consumption, very little bit. So Morton salt, that is where most of us get our salt. I don't know about Morton's. I guess that's probably the brand that everybody knows. Based out of Chicago, Morton salt is famous for this phrase, of course we all know, when it rains, it pours. And the reason it pours is because your Morton salt has magnesium carbonate in it, which is a drying agent. And magnesium carbonate is also the same stuff you see the guys at the gymnasium, you know, hitting on their hands to chalk up, okay, in the Olympics, all right? So that's why when it rains, it pours. When it gets humid, salt would clump together. But Morton's puts in a little bit of magnesium carbonate, and that keeps salt flowing, okay? Now, another aspect of salt that we've heard about is iodized salt. And I've heard different things from people, like, that's good, that's bad, and we'll talk about why it's probably good. A lot of people don't get enough iodine in their diet. And iodine is intimately important for the function of the thyroid gland, which I suppose most of us know is up here in the neck and has a large effect on the metabolism in the body. And this is an area in the United States called the goiter belt, okay? Before salt was iodized, before they added potassium iodide in small quantities to salt so that people who would seek out salt for different cooking purposes and so forth, they would get their iodine through the salt. Before that, there was a great amount of goiter in this part of the country because there's very little iodine in the water, okay? Now, we talk about health conditions now, but this would not be an uncommon finding. Now, this one is a little bit beyond belief, but these kind of goiters were developed for people who had spent, you know, years and years of their childhood without iodine at all in those northern climates. So it's pretty wild to imagine. And this kind of goiter would be very common. This was, of course, extremely uncommon, but just a wild understanding of what people used to see, you know, in the countryside. You'd see people in the northern climates, and they'd have these huge goiters, and they iodized salt to prevent that. Now, salt is also intimately involved in the history of the human race for a variety of reasons, primarily because it's a preservative. It was the original preservative for foods. And to be honest with you, Venice made its fortune, its initial fortune, on salt, the trading of salt and the taxing of salt, because all people needed it for food preservation, okay, in the 1500s and 1600s. And there are cities that are named after salt, for instance, in Austria, Salzburg. Now, there's a place you all know that you probably don't think of much, Salt River. Where did it get that name? The answer is you cannot find out where it got that name. There is no answer to why there's a Salt River. There is nothing salty about the Salt River, as it turns out. And if you read stories on the internet, which is, you know, where I did the research, but it's as good as any place. If you look for an answer for why Salt River is called Salt River, there'll be some apocryphal stories about some salty shrub that lived next to the Salt River, and it tasted salty, so they called it the Salt River. And I don't think there's any natural occurring plant that tastes particularly salty. Can anybody think of anything naturally occurring that they have ever tasted that was salty, other than salt itself, like a fruit or a vegetable? That is naturally salty. I don't think it exists. Now, here in Arizona, though, surprise, surprise, there's a 15-mile-wide salt mine in Glendale, Arizona, which makes water softening salt, most of it, mostly. Not edible salt, but that's in Glendale. But there's no explanation that I can give you for why the Salt River is called the Salt River. Now, there are myths and some wisdom in salt. And here's some of the wisdom. And we've heard this in the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner. Does everybody know this one? Water, water everywhere. And all the boards did shrink, water, water everywhere, nor any drop to drink. So of course, this puzzled me when I first thought of this. Why is somebody on, you know, wrecked on shipboard, why can't they drink the seawater? Why can't they? Well, you say, well, because it's too salty. It's like, but what does that mean? Why can't you drink the seawater? And this is why. You cannot drink the seawater to survive because the maximum concentration of sodium in the urine is about 17 to 19 grams of salt per quart. That's the maximum amount of salt a person can make or can put into their urine. And the average seawater has 35 grams of salt. So there's twice per quart. So to eliminate a quart's worth of salt from the body that you got from a quart of seawater, you would have to urinate 2 quarts of liquid. And so it dehydrates you. It seems, I mean, we all know this, like you can't drink salt water and solve your thirst. And this is why. Your body, your kidneys cannot get rid of that much salt more concentrated than is in seawater. Now, this is a bit of a myth, and that has to do with water softeners. Okay. Now, people, I watch this commercial. Anybody see the infomercial on TV? You know, the water softener, Kinetico or whatever, they claim, you know, your salt is terrible for you because it's getting in your water and it's causing ill health. It is not true. First of all, does anybody have soft water here? Anybody? Some people have soft water. If you drink soft water, it doesn't taste salty. I think that's your first sign there's not a lot of salt in salt water or in soft water. But salt doesn't get into the water itself. The salt is a briny mixture that cleanses the beads that are in these containers of soft water. The beads themselves attach to the other minerals in water, and the salt itself is just for washing those beads off to get the minerals off of it. And the Food and Drug Administration defines it as a very low sodium. There is a little bit of salt that comes out of the softener into the water because it replaces the calcium and magnesium, other minerals, but it's very little. 12.5 milligrams out of a 2,000 milligram diet. It's very little. So there is a little bit of salt in soft water. There's some truth in it, but it's not salty. It's not dangerous for you in any way. Now, we talked about preservatives, and salt is the original preservative. This is the little preservative that could. I think I'm canned. I don't know. That wasn't that funny. It's the only cartoon I could find. But in the old days, I mean, back in the 1200s, 1300s, and really to the modern era, the only real preservative was salt. So all the foods that they would catch, fish, meat, vegetables, what could you do with them? You couldn't refrigerate them. You couldn't keep them. Something had to be done to maintain them. And that's why salt was incredibly important to the societies. So salting cod that came from the cold waters, salting herring, which was a fattier fish and had to be salted in barrels, because the fat would prevent it from absorbing the salts. So you had to compress the fish to force the salt into the fish that were fatter. Of course, the famous prosciutto ham, yummy. That makes me excited, I'm happy. But they would also salt things that were fresh that, I don't know, anybody ever have a pickled egg? Anybody here like a pickled egg? It's okay. Yeah, it doesn't look very appealing to me, but I don't know. But so they would pickle everything fresh, and pickling was essentially just using salt. And, you know, they talk about, like, as an example, another meat that I found interesting, corned beef. There's no corn in corned beef, which I never knew, to be honest with you. But corns were just the name for little pellets of either material like salt or other spices, and they would call those corns in the old days. So there's just a whole lot of salt in corned beef, to be honest with you, which I think we all know if you have any. The pickle was a very important staple back in, you know, for many, many centuries. And sauerkraut also, very important, because you couldn't get any kind of leafy green in the winters. So they would pickle it and create sauerkraut. If you're like me, you love to eat, and I love to eat. I don't know about this guy. I mean, that's, you know, this, do you know Guy Fieri? This is, you know, it sort of makes me proud to be an American when I see a burger that size. But it also makes you a little sort of disgusted, a little dirty. It's sort of like Woody Allen when somebody says, is sex dirty? And Woody Allen said, only when you do it right. Only when you do it right. Now, the recommended daily salt intake is 2.4 grams, okay? So who knows what that means? Now, I'm gonna make a distinction. I'll tell you what it means right here. It means 1 teaspoon, okay? That is approximately the amount of sodium, okay? Now, we're making a distinction here. This is sodium. And this is salt, okay? And we'll talk about this again. Notice sodium is about 2.4. Salt is about twice as much because that includes the chloride that's added, sodium chloride, okay? So the amount of salt we're looking at, sodium is 2.4. The amount of salt is 4.5 grams. And you'll see this confused back and forth, and we'll show you this, even in a lot of references. So we said 1 teaspoon a day, that's it. That's how much you're supposed to have. And actually, that teaspoon needs to be flattened out. So where's the salt in our diets? Well, there really isn't a lot in natural foods. That is, you pick a grape or an apple. There's not a lot of salt in it. But anything that humans have tried to preserve or get their hands on and adulterate is going to have salt in it. Okay? So a salt packet has 400 to 700 milligrams of sodium. Okay? So I translated this. So 4 to 5 packets is it. That's it for a day. Okay? Potato chips. Now, this is interesting. Trying to knock potato chips in, in one of the sources I had. They were saying, oh, potato chips are terrible. They have 400 milligrams of salt in them. Well, now that's salt, okay? Remember, sodium is half as much. That's about 200 milligrams of salt. Notice they said up here, a salt pack has this much sodium. Then they said salt. You have to make that distinction. Sodium, just the sodium component, or salt, its entire, the entire molecule. So 6 bags of this would be the entire day's worth. A Big Mac has 1,000 milligrams of sodium. So 2.5 of those, you've got your day's worth. Large French fries, 330 milligrams. And I must tell you, that's a lot, but that sort of made me happy. It wasn't as much as I thought it would be. I thought one Big Mac and I'm done. I'm over the limit. But you're really not. You're really not. Now, I was sort of shocked that pretzels weren't so good. That really bummed me. 10 pretzels is 400 milligrams, 1/6 of my daily intake. Okay. The Chinese essentially developed the first preservations with salt back 6,000 BC, but they didn't use a lot of salt, but they used sauces, okay? And soy sauce, which is prepared from a certain form of soybean, and has a huge amount of salt added to it. So 1,000 milligrams of salt per tablespoon. If anybody goes to the sushi restaurant, you put that's sodium. So 2 tablespoons of this sauce in one of those little things and you dip your sushi in, you're done for the day. And the Chinese used soy sauce, so it's thought, because it extended the use of salt. It made it so they could make it go further and further, okay? But you'll find that in the Asian cultures, they don't use that much salt, but they use sauces that have intense amounts of salt in them. Cold cuts, again, you know, I'm like the poster child for eating too much sodium, I suppose. 700 milligrams in 2 slices of ham, okay? So you do that, that's a quarter of your daily, right there, 2 slices. And then all canned vegetables, soups, they're all gonna have quite a bit of sodium generally in a serving, 600 to 2,000 milligrams, it can be off the charts. So how do we combat this? What do? Well, government to the rescue. We developed the DASH diet. Has anybody ever heard of the DASH diet? Okay. It's sort of a fun name. Dietary approach to stop hypertension. So this connection between high blood pressure and salt, it's felt that if the population reduces its salt intake, will reduce blood pressure broadly. Now, if you reduce blood salt intake from, let's say, 8 or 10 grams a day, which is a lot of salt, to 2 grams, on average, you lower the blood pressure in the United States by about 4 points. Doesn't sound like much, but that adds up to a lot of reduced stroke and heart attack. Now, to give you an idea, in the old days in Europe in the 15 and 1600s, 1700s to 1800s, people would eat, because they salted so much, 50, 60 grams of salt a day. You can imagine you couldn't live very long with 50, 60 grams of salt a day. You know, 20, 30 times what we eat now. But looking at the DASH diet, and this is the classic pyramid form, let's start with these things that don't have a lot of salt in them, okay? So we're starting with vegetables and fruits. I mean, these are things, there is not a lot of salt if you take something that's growing in the earth. It doesn't have a lot of salt in it. It probably has about as much salt as you and I have in it, that concentration, if you will. It's not particularly salty. And remember, from the water lecture, if you take a fruit or vegetable, probably 80 or 90% of a fruit is water. So it's pretty wild. When you're eating a fruit, you're mostly eating water. Grains, whole grains, have very little salt in them. Here's a little bit of dairy. Meats, you know, unless you're adding a lot of salt to it, there's not much salt within them. Dressings, beans, seeds, and then sweets. Very low salt in this combination. And I think it really stresses the idea that we need to focus in down here at the bottom, at least, of this pyramid, looking at the fresh fruits and vegetables, something that's not prepared, that hasn't been touched by other people and we're preparing it ourselves, that's where we can limit our salt. So you gotta eat your fruits and veggies. This isn't news to anybody. And the bottom line is eating less salt. It is important for all of us. It's hidden in all of the prepared foods. So if it's been touched by humans, prepared by humans, salt is part of it. And it's important to try and reduce it. That's it. That's the talk on salt. Thank you very much.